Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, this is Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast of the Financial Times. I'm Cardiff Garcia. This week, producer Amy Keene and I are working on a couple of projects, so we are going to play for you an encore episode of our chat with economist Sebastian Edwards, plus a bit of updated bonus material. So Edwards, if you don't remember, or if you didn't listen to that original podcast episode, was one of the pioneers in the systematic study of economic populism, along with his longtime collaborator, Rudy Dornbusch. And this was a really fun chat that we recorded in February. But because that was not long after Donald Trump had been inaugurated as president, we didn't have as much evidence as we do now about the extent to which Donald Trump would actually follow the pattern of economic populists in the past, the ones that Edwards and Dornbusch have in fact studied. So we're going to play for you that episode again, and then after the replay is finished, I'm going to give you a few of my thoughts on this point about whether or not, at least to this point, Donald Trump has in fact been following those patterns of previous economic populists. Here it is. Sebastian, thanks for joining us.
Hey, I'm excited to be here. Hi.
Let me start by talking about your early personal interest in populist economics. You yourself are Chilean. How did you first start becoming interested in the economics of populism?
Well, anyone that was born in Latin America and is interested in economics unavoidably ends up sooner in general, worrying about populism. The early work started when Alan Garcia took over the presidency of Peru for the first time. There was Alan Garcia I and Alan Garcia II. And Rudy Dornbusch and I were absolutely fascinated by the disregard that Garcia had for anything that resembled good economic policy and how he just wrecked Peru. And we said, well, this is one more manifestation of a more general phenomenon that comes back again and again and again in Latin America. And we decided then to write our first paper, an article where actually we compared Alan Garcia to Salvador Allende in Chile.
Yeah, Garcia was the 1980s.
Right. And Allende was in the early 70s, from 1970 until the Pinochet coup in 73. And then we started working on other cases, Perón in Argentina, Getulio Vargas in Brazil. And so we built a body of work and then convinced others to start working on populism. And then we did a book. And so that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I recently moderated a panel about the Mexican political and economic outlook. And something that the panelists said, and also a few people in the audience, was that Americans have been taken off guard by some of the phrasings of Donald Trump and some of what he at least says is part of his agenda. But that if you're from Latin America, you've sort of seen how a lot of this movie plays out before.
That is correct. You've seen it before. The modus operandi is very similar, and it's very ironic. On the one hand, you have Donald Trump, and the way he approaches many of these issues are not too different to what Hugo Chavez did in Venezuela. And that's exactly what makes this whole story quite fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. So before we actually get to Donald Trump, which I think we're going to sort of save for the end of the conversation, I want to get into some of the basics. When you talk about populism and populist leaders, what definition are you using? Because I get the sense that the word populism is sometimes used differently by different scholars and by different people, and there's a lot of talking past each other.
That is correct. So Rudy Dornbusch and I defined the economics of populism as economic program, a package of policies that disregarded good, solid, received wisdom on economics. And in the case of Latin America, which is going to be interesting when we compared it to Donald Trump, disregarded all budget and monetary constraints and violated all those constraints, and the populists do, in a way that generates euphoria in the immediate short run, but ultimately results in a very deep crisis that affects in particular those that were supposed to be benefited by the whole program. So populist economics is an economic policy package that disregards budget constraints, macroeconomic constraints, good, solid productivity constraints, and generates short-run benefits at the cost of crisis in the future.
Yeah, I got the sense that a big part of that also was a kind of disregard not only for the principles of sound economic management, but for the existing institutions in place that are supposed to enforce those principles.
That is correct. So those are the policies, what I described. And what the populist leader does then is that in a rhetoric that is quite extreme, and where he or she divides the population between us, the people, and them, and it's vague them, and we'll get to that in a minute. In that rhetoric, the populist leader takes the discourse directly to the people through big rallies, referenda, plebiscites. I'm talking about Hugo Chavez and Donald Trump, who continues to be, although he's now the president, in campaign mode. And in doing this, skips the institutions, both at the economic level. For instance, they tend to dislike the central bank, because it is an institution that tends to maintain sound policies in most countries. First thing that Hugo Chavez did was fire Mrs. Ruth de Crivoy, the governor of the Central Bank of Venezuela, right? So they disregard the institutions, both economic and political. That is absolutely right.
Yeah, there's something else that's interesting about your work. Because you've spent so much time studying Latin America, it turns out that the majority of the populist leaders you've studied have been left wing, right? A lot of Marxists in there. And it's interesting to me that in your work, you don't actually look at populism as a left-right issue. So can you sort of elaborate on how that works?
Yes. These false promises that the populist leader offers to the people may come from the right or from the left. In some way, Perón, who had great sympathy for the fascist movements, he was a great admirer of Benito Mussolini, was a right-wing in many respects. So there is no reason why we cannot have corporatist right-wing populist leaders that favor specific groups in their rhetoric and in their policies. And again, very clearly blame, in quotation marks, the other for the suffering of us, the people. And in the case of Latin America, often the other was related to some foreign force, the multinationals, international speculators, and of course, the International Monetary Fund. And what is very ironic is that in the case of Donald Trump, and very interesting, of course, foreigners also are blamed for the plight of the people. And in this case, are immigrants, the Chinese, and international terrorists.
Yeah. Okay, let's go through some of the findings of your work. And let's start by talking about the conditions in place that usually precede the rise of a populist leader.
Well, yeah, the first phase is a deep public dissatisfaction and discontent. And this dissatisfaction and discontent is of two types. Sometimes it's quite abrupt. And in Latin America, usually that abrupt crisis has been associated historically with a very large devaluation of the currency. So we go back to Argentina, 2001, 2002, peso, dollar, one-to-one for 10 years, and all of a sudden there is a huge crisis and the currency goes from one peso, $1, to 3 to 4 pesos, $1. And that generates a very deep sense of dissatisfaction, of betrayal. So there is the crisis. In other cases, the crisis sort of develops much more slowly, and it's a simmering crisis. And that is what we can see in the United States, where there's this simmering dissatisfaction, in particular among white blue-collar workers. So first phase, great dissatisfaction, and you can see it in country after country after country. Venezuela, Caracaso, and the big riots, Argentina, the big devaluation. In Peru, the failed presidency of Fernando Belaunde after the return of democracy. And we can go on and on. And in the case of the U.S., it's income stagnation, wage stagnation among a large group of manufacturing sector and natural resource producing people. I'm thinking of coal in West Virginia and Kentucky and so on. The second phase is the emergence of this populist leader, very charismatic, who operates outside of the political institutions. In general, he or she, mostly have been men, does not have a political party or is a newcomer into politics. So Perón comes from the armed forces. Alan Garcia has a political party, the APRA, but the APRA in Peru has been outlawed for so long that has not played a role. Chavez comes from the military. Rafael Correa in Ecuador, he's a technocrat. He has a PhD from the University of Illinois. So he's been a technocrat that has been completely outside of the traditional political system. Evo Morales, same thing. Now, Donald Trump, of course, disconnected and, in fact, disliked by the... So this leader that comes out is extremely forceful, very articulate. And in rallies and in direct appeal to the people, provides this very nationalistic rhetoric and gets the people to approve this particular political program that disregards all sorts of constraints of good, solid economic management. And either you cut yourself off from the International Monetary Fund, famously Peru stopped paying its debt to the IMF, one of the few countries in the history of the IMF. And in this first phase, there is a fantastically positive reaction in the economy. More so in Latin America than what we're probably going to see in the U.S., because what the Latin American populist leaders do is that they blow out the international reserves that the country has. And they fix the exchange rate at an artificial level, and everything is good while they are spending all the reserves that they have for that particular time. And then comes the crisis. The fourth phase is the crisis.
Right. Before we get to that next phase, still talking about like the conditions that lead to the emergence of a populist leader and a populist economics. You mentioned wage stagnation and dissatisfaction. What about income or wealth inequality as a precursor to fomenting a lot of the anti-elite sentiment?
That, of course, goes with it for several reasons. Most of these crises have a different effect on different social groups and income groups. And again, if we go back to the work that Rudy and I did originally, if the crisis has a nature of very high inflation and eventually a large devaluation, the upper classes, of course, have moved all their money into dollars or foreign currency and then moved it to Miami banks in Miami or Panama. So they are protected from the crisis. So there is a dissatisfaction that is much stronger among lower income people, which is also the case in the U.S. The Argentine crisis is of 2001-2002, which resulted in the successive presidents, and ended up with Duhalde and a long Kirchner presidency, Nestor and then his wife, was particularly severe in terms of income distribution. And the poor in Argentina suffered very significantly during that period.
Okay, so we have this first phase that follows the enactment of populist economic policies, right, where the economy gets a big sugar high, essentially. And you mentioned that in the case of Latin America, they start blowing through their FX reserves. They start exploding their budget deficit, right? What happens next?
So here is where the story probably is going to depart, and it's going to play a little differently in the U.S. But what has happened in Latin America and in other parts of the world, Russia, Turkey, I mean, it's very generalized, is that as the international reserves are depleted, then the country at some point cannot import goods anymore using the very cheap currency value. And usually the first step is that the price of gasoline and oil-related goods is hiked. And that results in the price of public transportation going up, and that results in riots. And there are generalized riots, and we saw that in Caracas. We've seen that in country after country after country, that as soon as the price of public transportation is doubled, sometimes it's tripled, then the population becomes very, very unhappy. It is a direct hit to their pockets, and there are manifestations and or riots. And of course, the populist leader continues to blame the international speculators and price gauging by the elite and so on and so forth. The IMF may come into the country, but the populist leader says they want to impose on us austerity and we're not going to accept that. We've seen that in Africa again and again for ages. And this gets prolonged until politically it's untenable and something happens. And in Latin America, many times that something was a coup d'etat. And the military stepped in and there were people killed. And at the end, there was a lot of repression. And the poor, who were supposed to be those that would benefit from the populist program, end up being much worse off.
Yeah, there's a nice point made in one of your early papers with Rudy, where you write that the problem with the outcomes that you described, in addition to what's obvious, is that capital can flee, but labor is trapped in the country. In other words, the foreign investment that might have been necessary to keep propping up these asinine policies can turn around and leave the country, and leaving nothing left there for investment, but the workers themselves have nowhere to go. They're stuck there, and so the people who were supposed to benefit end up losing out the most.
And that is related, of course, to what I was saying earlier, in the sense that the rich always have a way of putting their money in Miami banks, or when it came to Cyprus, they move the money to Greece, and they protect themselves.
Yeah, no, it invariably leads to a very sad outcome.
But what is very interesting is that, as we said, and as you reminded me, capital can flee, the people are trapped, but they try to get out. So the saddest picture to the eye in Buenos Aires in the early 2000s were the lines of professional young people in front of the Spanish crisis had not occurred yet, the Spanish and Italian embassies. People that were trying to emigrate from Argentina, trying to get around the fact that they were trapped there.
Let's talk about something that you alluded to earlier, but that might also be a part of the U.S. story, in addition to having been a part of these Latin American crises, which is the degradation of the rule of law. In other words, when you talk about going around the institutions, ignoring them, one of those institutions is just the simple faith and confidence of the people who invest in these businesses in Latin America and in the U.S., when you see the leaders of these businesses either being berated by a political leader or, in the more extreme cases of Latin America, in some cases nationalized by the government, it ends up undermining dramatically the faith and confidence in all of the remaining businesses. And eventually you get into a situation where nobody wants to do business in your country because nobody has any faith in the legal architecture.
Right, that is correct. So one of the most important aspects of capitalism is that it should be quite impersonal, and all companies should be treated by the authorities equally. And that, of course, is translated in international trade to the most favored nation, where every nation should get national treatment. And what we see in many of these populist experiences in Latin America is that the authority starts picking up on specific companies, firms, conglomerates, and the strong man or the strong woman, Cristina, in Argentina, would call the CEO or the controlling figure of that company and would threaten him or her personally, or would denounce that company in public rallies, and would indirectly direct the mobs to riot and to maybe even break into those stores. And then they are called in and they are said, you have to reduce your prices, or you have to do this, or you have to do that, and you have to raise wages by 50%, while at the same time you cannot increase the prices of your product. Which, of course, it's a variant of what Trump is doing with companies that want to invest and start plants in other parts of the world. So the rule of law, and in particular the impersonal treatment, equal treatment of everyone in front of the regulators and so on and so forth, starts to disappear. And since the populist leader maintains himself in power by feeding this notion that there is this foreign force outside the country that is trying to keep the people down, he needs these enemies, and it's a little bit unavoidable. And again, we can see the parallels with what is happening right now in the U.S. with Donald Trump.
Yeah, it seems, by the way, like your definition of what constitutes economic populism is similar to a definition I've seen of political populism that's been recently advanced by a political scientist named Jan Werner Mueller, where he says that it's not enough for someone just to be anti-elitist. The real key is that they are also anti-pluralist. In other words, that they identify either people or entities, companies outside of the quote-unquote true people, right? And those entities and people have to be delegitimized because only that populist leader has access to the real feelings and the real needs and the real wants of the people. And the people are, of course, however he defines them to be, right?
It is very similar in that regard. There is this notion, the populist leader presents himself as illuminated and being able to see through clouds and through all sorts of impediments, including political parties, the legislature, the Supreme Court, the central bank, the budget office, and see through, and then able to undertake particular policies that are going to solve everyone's problem. And of course, it doesn't happen like that. Checks and balances are gone quite early on in the Latin American populist experience. It happened in Turkey. It happened in Russia. I don't think it's going to happen in the U.S. I cross my fingers.
Yeah, I mean, to give you a couple of other examples where Trump seemed to be leaning in that direction, although it's really hard to tell right now how far he would go. In addition to the tweets that you mentioned where he criticizes specific companies for not, you know, going along with his agenda, we have to remember that he said during the campaign that elections are legitimate if he wins, but they're rigged if he does not win. the media that praises him is fine, but if not, then the media is the enemy of the American people. Those are his words, you know. The intelligence community is okay if they're digging things up on Hillary Clinton, but if not, then they're like the Nazis, all right? Again, from a tweet of his, I'm not just saying that for exaggerating effect, right? And so what's hard for me to tell is whether or not he's using these tactics from the populist playbook to try to further his agenda because he's seen that they work, or if he himself actually has ambitions to go that far or to test the limits of those institutions to see how far he can go.
I don't know what the answer is. I mean, there are two alternatives. Either the level of ambition and desire to grab power is much greater than what any of us imagine, or the level of knowledge of U.S. history and how institutions have functioned in the U.S. is very low. I, at this point, think that it is the latter, that there is a deep degree of ignorance in terms of the way the system works. I mean, if you go back, I'm writing now a book about what happened in the U.S. in 1933, which is when FDR came to power. And the Democrats had an incredible majority in Congress. And after the 1936 election, it was absolute in every sense. But yet, FDR had to act according to the institutions. And when he tried to pack the Supreme Court, it was his own party that turned against him. And Senator Burton Wheeler was the one that led that effort, who was a populist from the Midwest. So I think that checks and balances go early in the populist experiences in Latin America. And I suspect that President Trump does not quite understand that there are severe limits to executive power.
Sure. You mentioned earlier, going back to the economics, that you suspect that in the U.S., the outcomes of these populist, tactics or these populist attempts will play out a little bit differently from the way they did in Latin America. I totally agree with you, but let me first just ask how you think it will differ from what happened in all these different Latin American instances.
Yeah, well, I mean, very important is that I think that independently of any desire, attempt, or effort by President Trump, the Federal Reserve will continue to be the Federal Reserve. It's a very important, solid institution. It's about 100 years old. It was founded in 1913. And we are not going to see the kind of disregard for good economic policy that resulted in the huge inflations in Latin America. So I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is that the U.S. has judicial review and the judges interpret what the Constitution says. And that's very unique of the United States. And that's not the case in Latin America. And it's much easier to fire judges or pack the courts. Cristina Fernandez in Argentina packed the court several times.
I want to stay with this idea, though, that institutions are probably stronger in the U.S. Not probably. They certainly are stronger in the U.S. Than they were in Latin America, and thus better able to handle, you know, whatever testing of their limits the Donald Trump presidency, you know, attempts. In terms of the Federal Reserve, I actually do worry a little bit, not that the Federal Reserve is going to be overthrown or anything so dramatic, but that because the Republicans are in office now, that there might be some kind of an erosion of its independence, especially if Janet Yellen starts to raise interest rates faster than Donald Trump might want her to, if he tries to pass some kind of a large fiscal package, if they actually manage to get that through, and that then she starts raising rates and either he starts packing the Fed with what you might call political appointees. In other words, he'll slowly politicize the Fed, or the Republicans actually manage to pass some kind of audit the Fed bill, right? That's one thing that I do worry about a little bit. The second is that if he ends up passing some combination of infrastructure spending and a large income tax cut, which was included both in his campaign proposals and is part of the Republican proposals that were offered last year, that it'll be, like in the 2000s, quite a regressive tax cut, and that if it blows out the deficit, that it'll limit the political maneuverability to combat the next downturn, right? That's another thing that I worry about a little bit. But finally, I think my biggest worry is that he continues on this path of berating companies, that he takes this approach that seems both corporatist and cronyist, that something else will come out that will just lead to a slower diminution of faith and confidence in American markets. And it could come from all kinds of places, right? The most recent example I can think of is that tourism is going to slow down because of these executive orders on immigration and on the so-called Muslim ban, and that's worrying a lot of people, that they just don't want to travel to the U.S. because they feel like it's going to be unpleasant, which makes sense. And then finally, that it'll sort of overturn longstanding norms of abiding by large multilateral institutions like whatever, the WTO, that will have a slower kind of protectionism, which is itself bad for the economy in the long term. So it might even produce a short-term wage boost to lower-skilled native-born workers if you have less immigration or if there's even emigration, right? And so I worry that it's a slower but still significant erosion of the norms and traditions that have made the U.S. economy strong in the past. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that you have a very strong point there. And as I said earlier, the dissatisfaction in the U.S. is more of a simmering type, and it has built through a long time, and it's not like explosive as it happened in Argentina, for instance, with the devaluation at the end of the De La Rúa presidency. And in the same way, I think that the erosion in the U.S. Will be much slower than in Latin America, as you pointed out. And I agree with you that all of those are issues to be worried about. But my main concern is protectionism. But still, it's unclear how it is going to play itself out. It's not impossible to think that NAFTA is going to come to an end, for instance. And that's pretty unilateral. I mean, they have to give notice, and then first there has to be some attempt at renegotiating. But I just came back from Mexico, and the degree of anxiety among political leaders of any party, PRD, PRI and the PAN in Mexico is much, much higher than what most people imagine here in the U.S. So protectionism, I think, is the way this will play itself out. I don't know, however, if we're going to see the border tax adjustment. It's just too complicated. I don't know if Trump himself understands it. If we insist going that way, the WTO is going to say no, and we may try to pull out or ignore the WTO. So again, erosion of institutions. And there we will see that there will be pockets of wage boost, or one town or another town in the Midwest that will get 1,000 jobs or 355 jobs because some company decided not to go to Mexico, or actually to invest, Michigan or somewhere. But of course, the final effect is going to be very negative for the lower classes in the U.S. I mean, basically, Walmart prices will double, and the rich don't shop in Walmart. They buy Ferragamo suits and Hermes ties in Paris. Now, the tourist effect that you mentioned is a very interesting one, because that is one that Trump will understand. And I am not sure if he owns properties that are subject to the very high seasonal demand for help. But of course, he does understand how hotels in Aspen and in Sun Valley and in Deer Park and so on, where the elite goes and plays during the winter, they can only function because they have all these foreign people that come and work there that come from all over the world. I mean, from Iceland, from Sweden, from Norway. I mean, these are not only brown people coming from Mexico. And definitely at every level, run-of-the-mill, middle-class type of facilities in Vegas, all the way to big resorts in Jackson Hole or wherever it is, are going to suffer from the kind of approach that he's taking towards immigration. And I think that is going to be very interesting. So he will understand that. He will get his friends and associates, his sons, telling him that this is going on. And I don't know how he's going to react to that.
Yeah, it's a good point that right now all of these things are hypotheticals. These are things to be worried about. They are not exactly certainties, in part because Trump is himself such an unusual figure that it just makes it hard to know how quickly he might change his mind on a bad idea if he gets enough pushback from the right institutions. There have been a few hopeful signs in that regard, some of them coming from the national security apparatus within the U.S., that he is amenable to getting rid of the people that, you know, should never have been there in the first place and replacing them with people who are a little more qualified. I don't know how that'll take shape in the economic realm. But my last question, I guess, is you've studied so many Latin American leaders. Which one does Trump remind you the most of?
Well, I don't think that there is one particular person that comes to mind.
Which combination of leaders and which traits does he have in combination?
Well, his nationalistic view reminds me, of course, of Perón in some regards. The anti-migrant approach is absent in most of these Latin American populist experiences. Large migrations within Latin America have been rare in history. There was a very large migration out of the Southern Cone into Venezuela, for instance, in the 1960s and 70s. But these were all middle class or upper middle class professionals, engineers, doctors, lawyers, and so on and so forth. And there was no pushback in Venezuela because of the oil economy was doing so well that they needed these people. What we're seeing now in terms of rejection of migrants, it's coming out of Chile. But no one imagined that because Chile has been so successful and it has become such a wealthy country in relative terms that now there are a lot of people that come from Haiti and Colombia and Bolivia, and there's some pushback in Chile. So, I would say Sam Perón. The rest is difficult to point him down. Someone may say that he has some resemblance to President Piñera from Chile because they are both very wealthy. But Piñera understands economics. He has a PhD in economics from a so-and-so university, from Harvard. So he does understand economics. And Trump, although he went to Wharton, doesn't seem to really grasp what's at play here.
Sebastian Edwards, your most recent book, I said earlier, was Left Behind: Latin America and the False Promise of Populism. What's the title of your upcoming book?
The title of my upcoming book is Broken Promises, and it deals with 1933 in the U.S. and the abandonment of the gold standard and what the large devaluation of the dollar, which was very Latin American in style and in magnitude. The dollar was devalued by almost 50%. That's very sort of Argentine. What were the consequences for income distribution, for politics, for the investment community, for financial markets, and so on? So it's a long book on only 1 year, and I've been having a great time working on it.
Yeah, that was a hell of a year, though.
It was a hell of a year, and there were lots of good things. The New Deal started, lots of bad things, Hitler.
Yeah, indeed. Sebastian Edwards, thanks so much for being on. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me. It was a very good.
Hey everyone, it's Cardiff again in the present day. So, here are the follow-up thoughts that I promised at the top of the show. First of all, on protectionism and economic isolationism, it does seem that, at least to this point, Sebastian's framework was in fact right and useful for predicting the way that Donald Trump would act. So, if you think about the treatment of refugees, the attempts to restrict even legal immigration, the more aggressive deportation policy, and of course, most recently, what appears to be a willingness even to end NAFTA if it can't be entirely renegotiated, plus the recent attacks on the World Trade Organization, including the blocking of appointments to vacant openings within it. So on the issue of protectionism, it looks like Edwards was right. Second, on the typical populist attempt at spurring a growth boom, here I think the record is mixed and, of course, incomplete, because we're still not that much into the Trump presidency. So Trump's efforts to cut corporate taxes, the deregulatory push in a number of industries, the attempt to cut taxes overall, the potential wealth effect from rising asset prices in the stock and housing markets, these could all be seen in this light. And thus far, it does seem like economic growth has picked up slightly. And yes, the stock market continues climbing. It seems like we get a record high every other day. But there's a lot of nuance here, too. So for one thing, how much of the trends I just described, the pickup in growth and the stock market booming, how much of that can be attributed to anything President Trump has done is a bit dubious. There are other causes involved here, too. For another thing, one of the single biggest economic decisions that the president still has to make is the selection of a Fed chair. And if he chooses someone who favors a steeper path for rate hikes than the path we're expecting now, he might see his boom go away right quick. Third, on redistribution. Well, you could interpret his brand of protectionism as an attempt, and I emphasize the word attempt to distinguish it from what the actual outcomes would be, but an attempt at geographic redistribution, trying to help the heartland rather than the coasts. And it's targeting the workers in certain sectors like manufacturing, mining, for wage gains, even if it has overall a deteriorating effect on the economy's long-term potential. But I got to say, for the most part, on redistribution, President Trump frankly seems to be doing the opposite of traditional populists. As Sebastian has shown, these traditional populists, even though they ignore sound economic fundamentals, at least in the short run, they do try to boost middle-class wages. But the gains, for instance, from Trump's proposed tax cuts would go largely to people with higher incomes and more wealth. And I say that, by the way, independently of any partisan belief on whether that's fair or not. I'm just noting the estimates of what his tax plan is likely to do if it gets passed. The same goes for his attacks to this point on Obamacare. So when some critics of Trump's economic policies, people like my colleague Martin Wolf, when they refer to the president as a pluto-populist, this is what they're talking about. President uses populist language, but in fact, these policies would not be very populist at all. But one final point, these critics are also referring to the conflicted business interests of President Trump and the people who work for him. That hasn't changed. The tolerance of dodgy business dealings by the people associated with his campaign and presidency, not to mention the Trump Organization itself and some members of his family. So a real open question here is the extent to which older norms, the norms of a presidential administration enforcing standards of propriety and decorum for the people who work in it, including, of course, the president himself, there's a real question as to whether those norms will be recovered after what have frankly been some quite flagrant violations. I don't really have an answer to that question. And that is the end of this week's Encore episode with some bonus material. We hope you liked it. We hope you enjoyed it all again, if it's the second time you've heard it. Thanks for listening either way, and please give us a call at 917-551-5012 or email us at alphachat@ft.com. To get show notes for this episode, dig into the archives at ft.com/alphachat. You'll find it back in February. And please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes. It really does help people find out about the show, and we see every single rating and review, so we really, really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to the amazing Amy Keene, producer and editor of Alpha Chat, and thanks to you, our listeners. We'll see you here next week for a brand new episode of Alpha Chat.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.